Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll be recapping the week in Utah news, including the windstorm that caused widespread damage and one death in northern Utah, the shooting by Salt Lake City police of a 13-year-old autistic boy, opposition from neighboring states to the Lake Powell pipeline, and a look at the timeline for a potential coronavirus vaccine and whether politics is involved in that timeline. On the phone for the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. And good morning, Matt. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Editorial page editor George Pyle joins us as well. And good morning to you, George.
Good morning.
And then later in the show, we will hear from Tribune reporter Andy Larson as well. Listeners, a reminder that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW if you'd like to join this discussion. Well, we will start with a news event that everyone, or maybe not everyone, but most people in northern Utah experienced this week, a major windstorm. Matt Canham, it's sort of odd to try to describe something that everyone lived through, but tell us about this windstorm and the damage that it caused. How did it start?
Yeah, this.
Where did it come from?
I'm going to blame it on California, just because it feels right. This is a windstorm that, you know, Utah gets these once or twice a year, the National Weather Service says, so they tend to be far smaller, more direct. We had one like this in 2011. Late 2011, hit Davis County, knocked over some trees. But this was broad, from Logan down to Sandy, the end of Salt Lake County. We had significant winds. We're talking 100 miles an hour, or at least approaching that, that knocked down thousands of trees. And we're talking big ones. These were trees over 100 years old in many cases that crushed cars and hit houses and changed the face of some of our cities, as Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall has said.
Yeah.
This was a bad one.
It was pretty remarkable. Obviously, a complicated situation. And I can't help but plug, once again, another KCPW show, In the Hive. Yesterday, we spoke with a National Weather Service meteorologist about how this storm came together, and you can check that out for the origins of the storm. The monetary damage, Matt, is substantial, though we don't necessarily know the whole price tag yet, right?
Right. I mean, this is hard. Individual cities are handling this in their own way, and some are asking residents to fill out an online form to explain whether they had damage or not. Some are going around monitoring themselves. There is talk of how do we clean up this much tree damage, and it's not really clear. You know, the hard part is if the tree was on your parking strip, usually that's the purview of the city and it's their responsibility. If the tree is in your yard, it's yours. And so a lot of the damage is going to be felt by individuals. If their tree in their yard fell on their house, that's something they're going to handle by themselves largely. And so it's not something that will necessarily go into official tallies. Now, a bunch of cities have declared states of emergency, as has the governor. And this allows for some federal funds to come in to help clean up the area. The governor also has deployed 200 members of the Utah National Guard to help clean up all of the trees that have fallen throughout northern Utah.
Matt, let's see here, Matt. You know, there's a power outages, or you know, were a major problem, and that complicated, you know, a number of things, including the fact that it was the first week of school. Some schools still weren't holding classes, and still aren't holding classes as a result of the power outages from this. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, the power outages remain a significant part of the story. As we're speaking, 44,000 customers, so that's individual homes or businesses, are still without power in northern Utah. At the peak, it was more than 170,000 customers were without power. So this is broad. And it did impact schools all over the Wasatch Front and back. It's now more narrow. Salt Lake City School District is the only school district that hasn't got underway yet. It's all online for the first part of the year. And they were supposed to start the day the storm hit. So obviously that did not work. And they have taken an incremental approach of deciding when they're actually going to get back going. Yesterday, they canceled classes about 20 minutes into the first class when they realized that they still don't have enough people with power, which meant that disappointed teachers and students and parents had to log off those who could log on. They have decided to give up the ghost this week and try to start again fresh on Monday with the start of school.
Okay, hitting the reset button. You know, I said on that show that I plugged, this is something that I said, but this is unlike anything that I've ever seen before here in Utah. I was born and raised here. I saw the 1999 tornado. You know, as a result of this, you know, the states of disaster were declared by various, you know, levels of government. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mendenhall, the mayor, said, you know, this is indiscriminate. It felt somewhat like a tornado without a path. You know, some neighborhoods that were even relatively close to each other had wildly different experiences. In Salt Lake City, the Rose Park neighborhood got hit harder than just about anywhere. But not the whole West Side, you know, just part of it. And I think that's frustrating for certain people. It really hit parks with established trees. So Liberty Park is still closed. The Salt Lake City Cemetery lost more than 100 trees, which damaged some gravesites. So there's a lot of cleanup. And so these national disasters or these state disasters, you declare them because it sets off a federal system to provide funding, because someone has to get paid to cut all those trees up, haul them away. And this is a process that will take weeks. Today is the first day the dump in the Salt Lake Valley will accept green waste for free. But this is going to go on for the rest of the month, largely. I think it ends on the 29th. And so that's, you know, if you have green waste you need to get rid of, you can take it out there. Just realize you might be waiting in a long line because there are a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, we talked to, you know, groups who are helping each other remove tree waste. You know, what's in short supply is essentially chainsaws, generators, and trucks. You're like, you know, there are still people without power trying to get by with a generator. And then the cleanup efforts are just going to be slow.
You know, it's interesting, the trees themselves. I talked to that meteorologist from the National Weather Service who told me that what was particularly rare about this storm, other than its intensity, was that normally these downslope wind events happen in the winter, and this one happened when the trees still had all of their leaves. And so actually it was the city forester who told me that basically the canopy of the trees got turned into a kind of wind sail as a result, and or at least made the profile of the trees bigger. And I don't even know, there's a lot to talk about there. There's also the fact that high-profile vehicles, a number of trucks flipped on the highways,
Matt. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
We had I mean, more than 40, I believe, semis tipped on the freeway. I saw one video where a semi tipped over and then slid into a semi that had already tipped over. Showing an area that was getting intense amount of wind. And what you said is right. I mean, this hit at a time where all the trees have their leaves. We've seen videos that people posted online where they do look like sails, where you could see the wind carry it and just rip the roots out, destroy, you know, sidewalks, and just knock these trees over. It's, you know, the urban forester said, you know, being a forester and understanding how this works, that this is the normal course of nature, that it's not a huge hit for our ecosystem, but it is a hit to our hearts. We love our big trees that are in our yard or in our parks or in front of our city halls. Or in, for me, I like the golf courses and they're all closed. You know, like, those trees are a part of our community and it's going to change. And that's hard to take for some.
George Pyle, editorial page editor, just, you know, I guess what I might ask you is how you wrote out this storm. I mean, what was your experience with it? And I mean, I've never experienced anything like it. How about yourself?
Well, I'm an old Kansas boy, so I'm not too frightened when the wind picks up. It is unusual for around here, though. And we were kind of lucky. We live down the hill from the university, and across the street there were some big old trees that fell down, and they just happened to fall away from the apartment building that they were next to, or that could have been really bad. On the other side, I mean, one tree fell on my neighbor's house from the house on the other side of them, bashed in their attic. And then we have a tree right in the middle of our front lawn, and you could see it was trying to tip over. The ground under the tree was kind of rising, and we just were sure any minute that the whole tree, roots and all, was going to tip over, and it just didn't. It just, the wind just wasn't quite strong enough at that particular spot. But now we've got tree limbs down all over the place, and right, those that were from city property on the street, the city or private crews that the city has sent have been out chipping them up. So should be a lot of mulch available this fall.
Right.
As you say, it happens when the leaves are still on the trees. Kind of thing happens further east when maybe you'll have a freak snowstorm in October, early October, when the leaves are all still on the trees, weighs down the snow sits on the leaves, gathers, gets really heavy, then the whole tree falls over. And as was the case here, the thing that most people notice is that the power gets knocked out in a lot of places.
Yeah. Hey, Matt, Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor, we didn't talk about, I guess, the amount of injuries that there were. There was, I think, one fatality as a result of this. I have to admit that I'm surprised that there weren't more, given just the amount of, especially tree carnage. But can you talk about that aspect of this story?
Yeah, the hospital system said there were a couple dozen people who had relatively minor injuries, which is, as you point out, quite lucky when you think of how much damage this caused. There was one man, a truck driver, who the wind knocked the door of his cab into his head, and then he fell and hit his head on the ground. That he ended up passing away from his injuries. He's the one person that authorities say has died from this storm. And it's remarkable there weren't more. I mean, we talked to a man and his son in the Rose Park area, I believe, who were watching a tree that was falling down, decided to go in the house, and the tree fell right where they were standing.
Wow.
I mean, it was by chance that they weren't there. You know, like, that could have easily happened to people, that they could have been crushed. You've seen the cars that were crushed. We talked to someone who was speeding away as the tree fell down and brushed the back of their car. And there's video of that happening, too. So, like, there were some close calls. A lot of people got lucky. There were some people who had some minor injuries from blown debris. It could have been far worse.
You talked about the cleanup, and we'll have to head to a break here pretty shortly, but you talked about the cleanup underway and the fact that, they're waiving fees out at the green waste, out at the dump. But what is the sort of cleanup plan, Matt? I mean, I know that for a period of time, at least, the city was saying, don't bring your private green debris out to the curb yet.
Right. You know, right now there's an attempt to be smart about this. Losing these big trees is horrible, but the wood is still valuable. And so there's an attempt to get some use out of those fallen limbs and fallen trees. And there's a couple ways that people are trying to do that. They're trying to do it locally, but they're also trying to save it for the Navajo in southern Utah, people who are reliant on wood for their heat. And so people are able to take the wood that they have, and they can bring it down to the Urban Indian Center in Salt Lake City. Then they'll help get it down to people. The Urban Indian Center is at 120 West, 13th South. They're collecting fallen wood that could be used for firewood. The city is also planning to pick up people's green waste in front of their yard, kind of like the old neighborhood cleanup we used to have. So So the city's trying to do that. And then it's, you know, this is all the way through our valley. So each city is kind of having to come up with their own plan.
Right.
All of the dumps we've contacted said they'll accept waste during certain, at least certain hours, for free. So no one's going to be charged for getting these trees out of their yard. But they are going to have to check with their local dump on the times and how they're going to do that. I think the dump, I believe, in Davis County, you have to prove that you are a resident of Davis County. So there are some things you might, hoops we might have to jump through to get rid of this stuff.
Okay. And there have been, as we said, you know, quite a few power outages as a result of this. I think that as of right now, taking a look at Rocky Mountain Power's status, 43,000 people are still without power in Utah as a result of this, although that's down from a high of above 170,000. Matt, anything else people should know before we turn to other news from this eventful week and actually head to our first break in the show?
This weekend looks like it's going to be really nice weather.
Matt Canham is Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, and you are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we will come back with the story of a shooting of a Salt Lake City, of a 13-year-old autistic boy by Salt Lake City police. We'll also turn to the latest on the Lake Powell pipeline. That's just ahead. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham and by Editorial Page Editor George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call us. The number is 801-355-8255. Well, Matt Canham, a police shooting has led to anger and to renewed calls for changes to how things are done when it comes especially to crisis response, that police shouldn't be used or should be used sparingly in certain situations. Anyway, Matt, a 13-year-old boy shot by Salt Lake City police. Tell us what happened.
So Golda Barton, the boy's mother, called police on last Friday to say that she was having a hard time with her son, who's 13, who's autistic. He was having a violent psych episode, is what the police described it as. She had a hard time with him. He was threatening someone with a weapon, is what the police were told. When they got to the scene, he ran. The mother told police that he no longer had any sort of weapon. One of the officers, at least one of the officers, fired, shooting him in the back, damaging his bladder and intestines, his ankles, actually. We're not 100% clear of how many shots were fired or what the officer what was the reason that officer fired. The body camera footage in this shooting is not yet available, but should be sometime next week. They did not find a weapon when they started providing medical care for the boy who was shot. He has since been transferred to a hospital. They are working on him. He, I believe, is stable at this point, but obviously very gravely injured. It is a situation that, you know, that comes at a time where Salt Lake City is grappling with this idea of when police should use force. And this one doesn't fit a lot of the expectations of when that might happen. And so there's a lot of questions still out there.
Matt, didn't this happen just before a new policy was set to take effect within the within SLCPD? Can you explain that part of this story? It has to do with de-escalation.
Yes. So because of past shootings and past protests that happened earlier this year, Aaron Mendenhall and Police Chief Mike Brown came up with an agreement on a new policy within Salt Lake City Police. This isn't state law. It's city policy. The de-escalation must be tried, not it's encouraged. It must be tried. And it changed how, when it's okay for Salt Lake City police officers to use force. That new policy was announced weeks ago. It went into effect 2 hours after the shooting happened. Now, yeah, as the police point out, they're not saying that, you know, there's no one who's saying that that policy, you know, we don't know exactly what happened, and so we don't know how that policy would have related. But there's an effort within Salt Lake City Police to limit the times where force is used, particularly deadly force. Shooting a young boy who is having a mental health episode as he runs away doesn't sound like it meets that criteria. But as I said, we don't have a lot of details, and that's something we'll learn more about next week.
Police shootings are under intense scrutiny right now. The anger, though, and the protests have generally focused on issues of race. Though, again, this is, you know, led to that idea of de-escalation and focusing on officers maybe not being called out in instances where a mental health crisis is happening or being used sort of sparingly in those instances. Are police able to say much right now about what happened? I mean, we're just waiting for as you said, body cam footage, but are they commenting on the what's or why's this happened?
They're not. They are just saying that they called it tragic and said that there was an investigation underway, but they're not commenting. But you're right. There has been talk. When we talk about use of force, there has been a lot of talk about use of force against people of color. Second to that has been talk about use of force in cases when people have, they're experiencing a mental health episode and they could, those situations could be handled in other ways. You know, police officers get some training when it comes to dealing with people who are having a mental health episode, but they're clearly not as trained as someone like a social worker or those who do that for a profession. And so there is talk in Utah and elsewhere about, is there alternative ways to handling those situations? When people need emergency help, the only place you can go right now is to call 911 and you get police. But there are circumstances where police might not be the right person to bring to those situations. And so that's, well, this tragic shooting will only amplify that conversation.
And on that point, maybe we can bring in editorial page editor George Pyle. George, you know, this child's mother said to KUTV TV, why not, you know, why couldn't police just have tackled him? He's unarmed. He's a kid. And I don't know. I mean, is it training? What's the change that has to happen here, George?
Well, we had just been, I mean, the Chief Mike Brown had been, I can't say in because nobody comes in to talk to us anymore. We had a conversation with Chief Mike Brown, the Tribune editorial board, virtually just a couple of weeks ago, and he was stressing that the movement in Salt Lake City and many police departments across the country is sort of changing from the idea that the measure of success being police officers all go home safe at night, and we're trying to change that to everybody goes home safe at night, not trying to move it to the place where, you know, in order to not shoot civilians, we have to tolerate police being shot. We don't want to do that. We don't want to shoot anybody. And then this comes along, and just on the face of it, we still have a lot to learn. It did seem like the young man was no threat to anyone other than perhaps himself. And that was, again, something that the chief specifically mentioned, is that using violence against a person who is only a threat to themselves, apparently, is not the right way to go. You reserve that for when someone is an imminent threat to someone else, an officer or a third party, which on the surface of it does not seem to be what happened here. There are other cases where police also get a lot of static when someone was armed but was running away or hadn't fired, or, you know, it's supposed to be like Dick Tracy, and you never fire, the police never fire first, but, you know, in a high tense situation, that isn't always how people think. I think they're talking now about de-escalation, about training. They have this super virtual training facility now where they do the shoot, not shoot training, where you are in this surround theater and they pose different scenarios, and you're supposed to decide in a split second, in a situation where no one's really going to get hurt because it's an exercise, shoot or don't shoot. So at least you have that experience. It's a difficult thing to manage, but I think part of it is that the culture, I think, kind of, the whole culture kind of expects police to be the cowboys who show up and shoot the bad guys, and they don't make very many movies or television shows about police who de-escalate and don't shoot anybody. That's not exciting, and that doesn't fit into a 60-minute TV show. So in addition to changing the culture of police, I think maybe we have to work on the culture as a whole.
That seems like a good point, George. Matt Canham, George brought up the the de-escalation training, but also he just described a scenario where police are running through a training sort of program and a surround sound. Anyway, well, the question that I have is, haven't police been through numerous rounds of de-escalation training to date already?
Yes, they have, and it's a job where police are constantly doing some sort of training. But when you talk to police officers, it doesn't sound like that's a burdensome thing. It sounds like there is always room for additional training or different types of training. The police academy this week talked about additional training. They have a meeting once a month where they go through disciplinary but also just policy issues. Major Scott Stevenson, who runs our police academy, talked about adding, I believe, another 30 hours of police training in a variety of areas of just what we're talking about. It includes how to interact with people of color. It includes more de-escalation attempts. An interesting point from the major, he believes sometimes police officers shoot because they are afraid to get in a physical fight. And he wants to increase the training in hand-to-hand combat so that officers wouldn't be as afraid to, say, tackle somebody if they need to. I don't know if there's data to back that up, but it's an interesting hypothesis and one that's going to lead to a change in how police are trained.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we're talking about the issue of people who are having mental problems, mental breakdowns, and there's many schools of thought on this, but two of them that are a little bit in conflict is that every police officer should have a little bit of training in dealing with people who are having severe mental issues, breakdowns, versus the idea that that's ridiculous, that just a little bit of training, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And what you need are specialists, and maybe they're social workers who aren't sworn police officers. Maybe they are police officers who have received a great deal of additional training and become specialists in the same way that some police officers are SWAT specialists or some police officers are narcotics specialists. You have trained, sworn, armed police officers who are specialists in this sort of thing and have more than a few hours of training in dealing with the mentally ill, and those would be the people who would be dispatched on instances like this and would be in charge at a situation.
Well,
and maybe, that officer is armed. Other officers who haven't received that level of training are there and are armed, but are following the lead of the officer who has had the extensive training.
Hmm. Matt Canham, do you know if, when it comes to crisis intervention teams and the idea of having experts who who are called out to deal with mental health, crises in the community from the police force, how that operates in Salt Lake City, since we're talking about a shooting in Salt Lake City?
Salt Lake City has social workers who work with the department, largely with issues involving people with mental health problems or people who are experiencing homelessness. But they're not really the rapid response team. They're the ones that come in afterward. So I think George's idea sounds like he might have some merit, but it's not one that's currently in practice. I have heard people in the Utah Fraternal Order of Police talk about that as a potential idea, a long-range idea. And there are, our crisis intervention teams that or some law enforcement use, and there are groups in Utah who are pushing that as a way to respond rapidly to these sort of situations, but I don't think those are widely used today.
Okay.
We need to get CBS to make an hour weekly TV show about a crisis intervention specialist or team, and have it, the season go 13 weeks, and he never shoots anybody.
And again, George talking
see
about
how long that show stays on the air. And I mean, you can certainly have a lot of drama and a lot of tension, and the good guys win. But I don't know, if there's no gunfire, maybe you could put some car chases in, and people would watch it.
Matt, just returning to and that's George trying to change the culture of the whole culture of the society we live in. But returning to the shooting, this 13-year-old boy, he is still in the hospital. Do we know his status before we move on to our final story here? How he's doing?
We don't know his status. We did reach his mother this week, who just said she's trying to be there for him. He is still hospitalized, but hopefully getting better. But that's all we know at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much, Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. And I wanted to squeeze in one final story, and we'll have to do this, unfortunately, kind of quickly. I didn't get Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands Reporter Brian Maffley on the show this week, but Matt, I'm hoping that you might be able to address the story of opposition from neighboring states to the Lake Powell pipeline. This is a project that is designed to move a lot of water from Lake Powell to the St. George area. But a number of states are saying, hey, hold on a minute. What are they saying and why?
Well, let's just start with where we are. People might have heard of the Lake Powell pipeline for years. This is a project that has been a long time in the making to move water down to St. George in that growing part of our state. The Trump administration has allowed for the environmental study to be fast-tracked. And so Tuesday was the deadline to submit your comments. And that environmental study could be acted upon as fast as by the end of this year. On Tuesday, every other state involved in the Colorado River Water Compact sent a joint letter to the Interior Secretary asking the Interior Secretary to hold off on this environmental study, to let these states, quote, try to reach a consensus regarding outstanding legal and operational concerns. Essentially, they want a veto on this project to make sure that what Utah does with its share of the Colorado River doesn't impact the share that everyone else is supposed to have as well.
Doesn't Utah have, you know, a water right? I mean, the ability to use a certain amount of water, and they're not using all of it, and isn't that their argument?
It is their argument. Utah does have a water right on the Colorado River, just like Nevada, Wyoming, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and California do as well. And Utah hasn't been using their share. Now, our partner states are saying our climate is changing, the water levels are dropping, we need to constantly renegotiate and reassess where we are, or Lake Powell and Lake Mead are going to go dry and we're in trouble. So while we have a legal right to a share, our partner states are saying this is a compact that needs to be renegotiated before Utah's action here could change what happens with this river.
So two things. One is, what does this mean practically for the state of Utah's plans to go forward, and also what is the state of Utah saying about the fact that these other states are opposing this project, or at least wanting to press the pause button on this project?
Utah is saying that it will work through its issues with its compact partners in the next couple months, and they are trying not to have this be a move that holds up this project. When you do a project, you know, this will be a $1 to $2 billion pipeline. This is a huge undertaking. And so this environmental study is key, but it is not the end of this fight. What these other states are hinting at is that if this doesn't end up getting held up or negotiated out in a different way, it will end up being negotiated in the courts. People will sue, environmental groups, possibly even these other states. And so they want to stop it now and negotiate it on the front end. Well, I did not see anything in this letter that said these states don't think Utah should be able to create this pipeline. I didn't see anything that was a line in the sand. but they want to know how much water and in what way and how it affects everyone else. But this thing, you know, those, as you know, those negotiations could drag on for years and years.
George Pyle, I'm going to give you the last word before we head to a break. The Lake Powell pipeline, opposition, not just from, well, opposition, again, a wrench in the works, you know, from neighboring states. I don't know. What do you want to say about it?
Well, just that, the building the pipeline is largely based on the you use it or you lose it water rights. We have water rights we're not using. We ought to use them. The other states, I think, are pointing out something that I think Utah has been pretty blind to in all of this, which is the assumption that the water that we have rights to will be there. I mean, if as climate change continues to change everything, causing windstorms, burning down Oregon, doing all these things, the assumption that the water that we have a right to will actually be in Lake Powell is a pretty iffy assumption, and that's what these other states are wanting to stop and slow down and talk about. And if they do wind up stopping the project, we might owe them some thanks, because then we won't spend $2 billion to pipe water that isn't there.
All right, George Pyle is editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're also hearing from Matt Canham, senior managing editor. We are going to take a quick break in the show, and then when we come back, we will turn to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, to save time for a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson about the status of the coronavirus vaccine. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. To save time for a recorded segment on the development of a coronavirus vaccine, we will turn already to our underplayed stories of the week. We'll have to do it quickly. George Pyle, do you want to get the ball rolling?
Well, yeah, I think it's underplayed just in comparison. California and Oregon are on fire right now. Oregon is evacuating 500,000 people around Portland. A couple of weeks ago, when two city blocks of Portland were faced with protests, some of which got kind of violent, the whole nation was looking and the White House was looking and saying, oh, my God, isn't this horrible? Now something really horrible is happening, and the White House is not returning Oregon's phone calls as they're seeking help.
Okay, an interesting pick on the burning West from George Pyle. Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story.
Senator Mike Lee has become a media critic. He has taken his personal Facebook page and has repeatedly targeted KSL.com as being anti-Republican, anti-Donald Trump, in part because KSL.com uses Associated Press stories that he thinks are too liberal. He is calling on the LDS Church to sell KSL.com if they can't rein the news website in.
A fascinating pick from Matt Canham. I'm going to actually forego my pick. It's a story about that Lee Davidson wrote about nuclear testing and the Trump administration's idea of resuming nuclear testing or conceivably doing that at the Nevada test site. Check that out at sltrib.com. Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham, editorial page editor George Pyle, thanks very much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the rest of the show, we'll turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Andy Larson for a look at where we are when it comes to a coronavirus vaccine. Take a listen. Andy Larson, I just checked, and this is now our eighth explainer on the radio on the pandemic, though, of course, you have done quite a few more of these deep dives in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Anyway, thanks again for joining today and more generally for your reporting efforts on this topic. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks. Thanks again for having me, and I hope to set a record one day.
That's okay. Perfect. We'll work on that. So where we are on a vaccine is the topic of today's discussion. And part of what you wrote about has to do with fears that the development and rollout of a vaccine might get politicized. And at the beginning of your piece, you say that there's actually some reason to fear that that is happening. Can you talk about that, Andy, just generally why there's some reason for that fear?
Yeah, look, I mean, so 82% of Democrats and 72% of Republicans kind of agree that they're worried about this process being politicized, which is pretty broad across the aisle agreement on any topic right now. But I think there is reason in that previous problems in this pandemic have been politicized, whether it was ventilators going from one to one state rather than another due to a favorable relationship with the government. The head of the FDA actually said that he may actually issue a emergency use authorization for one of these vaccines before a phase three trial completes. And so there's kind of all this evidence, and generally people are worried about everything being politicized right now. So I think it's that fear is not unreasonable that people think maybe, hey, this vaccine could be pushed out the door sooner than it may otherwise be, because it would be politically convenient for the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about the, as you just said, the FDA commissioner talking about kind of rushing through approval, even if it hasn't, you know, the vaccine hasn't gone through all of the, you know, the very last of the vaccine phases in the development of vaccine. You also talked about statements from the government about plasma therapy, Andy, that those statements, again, seem to be political instead of scientific.
Yeah, both the FDA secretary and the Health of Human Services secretary said that basically made false claims about the effectiveness of convalescent plasma therapy. And while I do think plasma therapy is a useful tool in treating COVID-19, it's maybe not the breakthrough technology or breakthrough solution that those two heads of state said that it was. So I think that's kind of the concern.
And of course, there's the president's statements, throughout this pandemic that on occasion or even frequently haven't been accurate. Hydroxychloroquine claims, for example. And then we learned this week about some comments that he made back in March to the journalist Bob Woodward. He said he wanted to, quote unquote, play the virus down, even though he knew it was much deadlier than the flu. Despite all of this, though, Andy, you are actually kind of optimistic about the vaccine development process and it not getting politicized. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, I was pessimistic until this week. And then I think there were two things that happened that really kind of changed my mind on kind of the whole thing. The first was that the nine big pharma companies that are working on these vaccines, the top candidates, got together and said, look, we will not apply for an emergency use authorization until after our phase three stage of vaccine trials are complete. In other words, it's a direct repudiation of what the directive of the FDA asked for and kind of floated out there. So for the big pharma companies to come together and say, hey, no, this won't happen on our watch, is a good sign, is a way that the thing of like, yeah, the adults in the room are still kind of in charge. And then the second thing is that we got this new clinical hold on the AstraZeneca phase three trial, which is that Oxford vaccine that we've heard so much about during the course of this pandemic that actually is the kind of the leader in the clubhouse in terms of these vaccines and where they are. And basically what happened is one patient had a spinal cord syndrome that basically made the researchers a little bit nervous, that it does come from viruses sometimes. But it also can be the result of other non-related symptoms. So that they would be willing to halt this trial, to put a clinical hold on this trial as they try to figure this stuff out and basically stop injecting people with this vaccine for a period of days or weeks, is really promising that, hey, the science is working here. There's something that we don't know what's up. We're going to investigate it. And pending the results of that investigation, we're going to wait. And then on top of that, we're going to make that public to everyone. So even though it's going to reduce our stock price, and AstraZeneca's stocks did fall 6% as a result of this news, they're still following the process. And to me, as someone who was, you know, skeptical about whether or not the process would be followed, when the process is followed, it gives me reason for optimism.
All right. So allowing scientists to do science, even the drug companies with concerns about being profitable or their stock prices, I guess, that's still a reason for optimism in your mind, and that the process isn't being rushed through. Andy, where are we in all of this? Are we close to having a vaccine? When might we see that happen?
Yeah, so kind of they're the three leaders in the clubhouse, where there's AstraZeneca, there's the BioNTech / Pfizer candidate, and then there's the Moderna candidate. And those are the three that started phase three trials in June or July, which would get them You know, if we really expedite these phase three trials, we're probably talking about a October end of those trials, kind of a 90-day process. If the AstraZeneca trial is delayed, which it is, that leaves the Moderna and Pfizer candidates. Pfizer, it said, their CEO said that they could have results by the end of October. Dr. Anthony Fauci and the head of Operation Warp Speed have both said that that's unlikely, albeit not impossible. So that's kind of pushing it. Moderna's had enough problems in their vaccine trials that realistically they're not going to be done until November or December at the earliest. So in terms of kind of getting a vaccine done before Election Day, we're really kind of down to probably Pfizer as the most logical candidate. And even they are really unlikely to get it there. So we're talking an emergency use authorization probably November, December, and maybe January.
Okay. And that, and of course that would be, you know, the vaccine, if assuming that it even happens, that would go to healthcare workers and those at high risk first, as you wrote in your column. And then for the rest of us, if there were, yeah, again, an emergency use authorization, because the vaccine had been shown to be effective, the rest of us, when would we expect to get it?
Yeah, it's going to be basically a couple of months, and it will depend on which of these vaccines ends up winning the race, so to speak. I mean, so for example, the U.S. government has a deal with Pfizer to give 100 million doses, whereas the deal with Oxford and AstraZeneca is actually a little bit bigger. So they kind of placed a bigger bet on the AstraZeneca side. The truth is, it's going to take time for these vaccines to be developed, for them to be, even the glass vials that these vaccines can be contained in. Most of them have to be transported at either negative 80 or negative 20 degrees Celsius. So that presents some challenges in itself. It's going to be difficult. And so essentially, you should expect, if you're a normal member of the population, that you're not going to be getting this until well into 2021. You know, spring or summer is kind of what you should be thinking. What's possible is we kind of get a mid-range where there's kind of a medium high-risk group that gets it next after the very high-risk health workers and nursing home workers and that kind of thing, right? And so that would be like teachers, for example, might be in that medium high-risk group, or people with pre-existing conditions. But those kind of details of how exactly it will be rolled out have not yet been announced.
Is there, I mean, this obviously all assumes that we actually have a working vaccine. Is there a chance that, I mean, Andy, that we won't?
Yeah, look, there is. I mean, the results that we've seen so far in the phase one and phase two trials of these vaccines have been very promising. And the odds are that, you know, among one of these three candidates, I would bet that one of them will work. But the truth is, phase three trials often result in failure. You know, you're looking at about a 60% rate of failure in these phase three. So if all, you know, if you've got three shots at it, now that your odds look pretty good. You've got a 80, 85, 90% chance of one of these vaccines working out. But the other news is that there are a whole bunch of vaccines, over 100 candidates beyond these kind of top three. So even if they aren't working out, you know, there's a Johnson & Johnson candidate, right, like to come at right after that. There are a gazillion other companies that are working on these kind of different approaches to this vaccine. And so it doesn't seem like this is an unsolvable problem with the amount of research that we put into it.
Okay, and these are the kind of Kentucky Derby win, place, and show bets that have been made on these three candidates. There's also this sort of question as to whether or not people will voluntarily take the vaccine, because as we know, there's a lot of people in the United States who are, what is it, skeptical, anti-vaxxers and so on. What does that mean in terms of how effective the vaccine is to the public in the United States?
Yeah, it has a huge impact. And, you know, I think not only there's kind of the anti-vaxxer irrational people, but I do think that there's a actually even larger subset of mostly rational people that just don't want to be the first to try it out, right? and I understand that reluctance. And so I think that's where the drug companies are going to need to be very public with this phase three data, and very clear in how they explain it to the public and be like, look, we have done the research on this. We've injected tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people with this vaccine already, and kind of make sure that the messaging is on point with the results. That being said, if, you know, there was a recent study that said over half of people in America would not be willing to take the first edition of this vaccine. And, you know, I think you can make some changes to that. But the truth is, you need people to take the vaccine in order for it to be effective. And that's kind of the problem that we're running into.
Speaking of problems, you end your column this week by issuing a kind of warning about what to look out for when it comes to the possible politicizing of the vaccine. What would present a red flag, Andy?
Yeah, first of all, I need to see the public data, right? I need to see the phase three data, make it public, I should say. So if they try to hide that behind closed doors, or it's not public when the emergency use authorization is issued, that would be a real red flag for me. The data we need to see, and scientists need to be able to look at it and say, hey, this looks good. You know, the trial has been worked in a way that makes some sense. And then I would also say that the director of Operation Warp Speed, his name is Moncef Slaoui. He's a doctor and a longtime medical professional, and he has said, look, if this process starts getting politicized, I will step down. And so, you know, if he steps down, or if a number of other health professionals in this area start to resign, and, you know, we've seen this in other aspects of the Trump administration before, that would be another red flag for me to say, like, okay, this isn't, you know, again, the adults in the room aren't making the decisions here. So those to me would be the kind of two red flags where I'd be like, I don't necessarily need to take that risk right now.
Wow. I mean, and that's obviously the threat of politicizing this, or of the appearance that it's been politicized, again, is even fewer people taking the vaccine. And it's just a conundrum, Andy, that we have to solve as a country.
Yeah, look, I mean, we have to do the science right, and then we have to explain that the science has been done right after we do it right. And if either of those two things fail, then the vaccine won't have the effect that we're hoping for, which is to get our lives back to normal.
Andy Larson is a Utah Jazz reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune and also a science-minded pandemic columnist for that paper. And Andy, I hope there's a day, you know, you talked about going for a record. I hope that there's a day in the future when we have reason to stop having this conversation. But thank you very much again for making time for it.
Thanks again for having me.
Andy Larson's reporting can be found at sltrib.com. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW 88.3 FM in Salt Lake City and on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.